Ayrım 17.
Sayfa 204. With individuals, this is clear. Whether we blame someone for something often depends upon how much he does know of the factors involved and upon how much he could be expected to know. Thus, the extension of reason is always an extension of the area in which we can exercise responsibility, and freedom cannot be extended without increasing understanding. It is on these grounds that Hegel links freedom and reason. It is often difficult in reading Hegel to be sure how far he thinks he is offering us a priori conceptual truths, how far he is offering us large-scale empirical generalizations, and how far he is pointing out what are characteristics rather than universal connections between concepts. Hegel's dialectical logic is specifically concerned with the last, but the obscurity of his language can leave the reader very unclear on large issues. So Hegel was perhaps trapped by his own obscurity when he increasingly concluded that history is an inevitable progress of freedom to higher and higher forms. The Prussian state and Hegel's own philosophy providing the culmination of this progress. But this later equation has unhappily discredited two key points that Hegel makes about freedom. The first is that the concept of freedom is such that once it is presented, no one can deny its claims. The testimony to this is the way in which conservative theorists insist that they are not enemies of freedom, they merely offer a different understanding of it. Illuminatingly, the differences between conservative and radical theorists usually turn out to be rooted in different and rival claims about the goals and desires of some social group. This is the source of the conservative myth about agitators, men who pretend to be spokesmen for what would otherwise be, and is in their heart of hearts a thoroughly contented group. According to Hegel, the reason why no one can deny the claims of freedom is that everyone seeks it for himself, and seeks it for himself as a good, that is, the merits he claims for freedom are such that it must be a good for everyone and not just for himself. Moreover, the connection between freedom and the other virtues is emphasized by Hegel as by no other author. In the philosophy of history, the master-serf relationship is exemplified in different types of kingdom, the Oriental, the Greek, and the Roman. And in the account of the struggle between patricians and plebs in ancient Rome, we are shown how the virtues of both parties degenerate so that power and ambition dominate the scene. More generally, Hegel's attitude to the qualities which we take to be virtues is a much more complex one than that of, say, Aristotle. Hegel shares many of Aristotle's valuations. He allows certain dispositions to be virtues in any society. He is certainly not a complete relativist, but unlike Aristotle, he is keenly aware that circumstances alter virtues. A precept or a quality which is admirable in one society may be used to oppress in another. Courage may be transformed into senseless desperation. Compare the last stance of the heroes of the Icelandic sagas, of Gisli the Sorsop, for example, with the last stance of the Hitler Youth in 1945. Generosity may become weakness. Benevolence can be an instrument of tyranny. To this, a number of replies may be made. An Aristotelian may insist that, by definition, this cannot be so. What is not done in the right time and place, to or by the right person, cannot be benevolence or generosity or courage. The doctrine of the mean shows it to be so. But this is too easy. Certainly, the critic may use the Aristotelian criteria after the event, but the agent who is acting with the only criterion he has is exhibiting courage or benevolence as he knows it. Then the reply will be that he does not know enough. But although this may be so, it would be odd, therefore, to say that what young Nazis exhibited was not courage or loyalty, but a mere counterfeit. The lesson is rather that virtues themselves may, for some people, in some circumstances, be weakness and not strengths. To this, a Kantian will reply that we are served by our motives and intentions. To which the Hegelian answer is that motives and intentions, too, are transformed in different settings. Even the Kantian goodwill may be corrupted. Again, the Kantian may seek a definitional defense. If corrupt, not the goodwill. But once again, this will not do. For by all the criteria available to the agent, his motives may exemplify the goodwill and yet be instruments of corruption. How this is so comes out very clearly in Hegel's sketches of various moral forms of false consciousness. By a false consciousness, Hegel means a conceptual scheme which both illuminates and misrepresents. So the conceptual schemes of individualist society are genuinely illuminating in that they bring out authentic features of that society and of its characteristic modes of theorizing, but misrepresent in that they conceal the limitations of individualism, partly by representing as universal and necessary features of the moral life what are only features of individualism. The first of these individualist doctrines is the kind of hedonism in which the dominant principle is the pursuit of one's own happiness. The trouble with this is that, as each person pursues his own satisfaction, he finds himself assessed by others in terms of his role in their pursuit of their happiness. He assists in creating a general situation in which the intersection of the various pursuits of private ends produces a series of dramatic crises. Each person becomes the fate of another. Impersonal forces of disharmony seem to rule. This leads to disillusionment, to the acceptance of the fact that life is ruled by impersonal necessities. This acceptance is then turned into a kind of inner nobility. The individual is one brand of romantic hero. He follows his way through a world he disdains. He is in fact a kind of high-minded hedonist whose doctrine equally with its predecessor leads to anarchic clashes. He does not seek pleasure now, but to follow the dictates of a noble heart. But in so doing, he finds others impersonal and heartless. In the next stage of individualism's self-development, the individual opposes himself to the external social reality, which has proved his enemy. In the name of virtue, he takes up arms against the world. The world must be defeated by virtue so thoroughly that it scarcely exists as an adversary. And once the world is no longer the enemy, virtue becomes virtue in the world, virtue that does the worldly duty which lies to hand. This is the phase of the individualist dialectic, which Hegel calls the spiritual zoo and humbug, or the affair on hand itself. In this phase, the agent does his duty in his immediate sphere without asking about the context within which he acts or the wider effects of his actions. He accepts deliberately a limited vision both of his actions and of his responsibilities. His is not to reason why. He lives in a spiritual zoo. The animals are all in separate cages. He boasts of minding his own business. He is the outcome of all good bureaucrats, of those technical specialists such as Eichmann, who boasted that they merely discharged their function in arranging for so much transport to be provided between point X and point Y. Whether the cargo was sheep or Jews, whether points X and Y were farm and butcher slaughterhouse or ghetto and gas chamber, was no concern of theirs. But of course Hegel's characterization applies also in every other sphere where the matter in hand is absolutized. Professor J. N. Findlay has pointed out how it illuminates the cult of pure scholarship, where a care for the truth alone is used to disguise the kind of self-seeking and competitive rivalry which pervade academic life. Footnote: Hegel, A Re-Examination, page 111. The worst of it is that in its devotion to the affair on hand, the individual reason now presents itself as a moral legislator. The task before you is your duty. First uttering imperatives to us, and then offering us a test of self-consistent universalizability, as we have already noticed in discussing Kant, lets in almost any action. It is not irrelevant to note here that the moral basis on which Eichmann himself claimed to have been educated was that of the categorical imperative. What is common to all these doctrines is that they are attempts by the individual to supply his own morality and at one and the same time to claim for it a genuine universality. As such, they are all self-defeating. For what gives a sanction to our moral choices is, in part, the fact that the criteria which govern our choices are not chosen. Therefore, if I make up my mind for myself, if I set myself my goals, I can at best provide a counterfeit of morality. Where, then, do I find criteria? In the established social practice of a well-ordered community. Here I find criteria proposed to me, which I can make my own in the sense that I can frame my choices and my actions in accordance with them, but their authority is derived not from my choice, but from the way in which in such a community they cannot fail to be regarded as normative. Thus, Hegel's final standpoint is that the moral life can only be led within a certain type of community, and that in such a community certain values will prove indispensable. He thus adopts a position different from both the subjectiveness and the objectiveness of the 18th century and of their later heirs. From the standpoint of the isolated individual, choice between values is open. But for the individual integrated into his society, it is not. Seen from within such a society, certain values impose themselves as authoritative upon the individual. Seen from without, they appear a matter of arbitrary choice. Plato and Aristotle saw the good as objective and authoritative because they wrote from within the society of the polis. The 18th century individualist sees the good as the expression of his feelings or the mandate of his individual reason, because he writes as it were from outside the social framework. Society appears to him an aggregate of individuals. But what for modern man can take the place of the polis? It is in his answer to this question that Hegel is at his least convincing. The Hegelian notions of reason and freedom are essentially critical. Their use is to point to the inadequacy of any given social and conceptual order. But Hegel, in the culmination of his systems, speaks as if they represent ideals that can in fact be achieved, as if they are specifications of an ideal, and finally, true and rational, philosophy and of an ideal, and finally satisfactory social order. With them, the absolute will have come upon the scene. The final reconciliation of God and man symbolized in the Christian doctrine of the last things will have been achieved. And this Hegel, after the phenomenology, seems to believe. In the logic, he can write that the thoughts he is uttering are the thoughts of God. Indeed, his mature philosophy entails that he and King Frederick William are parts of the contemporary incarnation of the absolute. The arguments by which Hegel reaches his conclusion are exceptionally bad ones, but his conclusion is not quite so entirely absurd and despicable as it is sometimes represented to be. Those to whom it is said that Hegel exalted the state, and the Prussian state at that, often conclude that Hegel was therefore an early totalitarian. In fact, the form of state which Hegel exalts is a moderate constitutional monarchy, and his praise of the Prussian state is based on his, not entirely correct, belief that the Prussian state of his own day was such a monarchy. Hegel can rightly be called a conservative, but in so far as he praises the state, it is because the state incarnates, in fact, so he believes, certain social and moral values. Suppose, however, that one dispensed with the Hegelian absolute but otherwise remained a Hegelian. What conclusion would one reach about morals then? In the first instance, perhaps the conclusion of the young or left Hegelians that the free and rational community, which will be the modern version of the polis, is not yet, that it has to be brought into existence. But how? Hegel's own mature belief was that the whole of human history exemplified the self-development of the absolute idea in its progress through self-estrangement to a final reconciliation with itself. The cosmic pageant is a drama which gives meaning to each separate historical episode. The absolute, not to be identified with any finite part of the historical process, achieves its own realization in the development of the whole. The older Hegel treats the absolute and its progress in history more and more as Christians have treated notions of God and his providence. Less and less does he note his own earlier warnings against the danger of construing Christianity literally, of confusing symbol and concept. He thus treats the whole of history as exemplifying some kind of logical necessity, as exhibiting a development in which one stage cannot but give way to its successor. And as the connections between stages are logical, as they are exemplifications of the movement of the idea, it is natural to construe Hegel as believing that the rational progress of man in history is essentially a progress in thought. One epoch replaces another by thinking more thoroughly and more rationally. It follows that historical progress depends on progress in thinking. This conclusion was retained by the young Hegelians long after they had abandoned belief in the absolute. They took it, in fact, that their task was to cleanse Hegelianism of its religious and metaphysical elements, and to do this by philosophizing better than Hegel himself. So also in the political sphere, what counted was the success of their theorizing. They therefore embarked upon the criticism of religion and of political institutions. Of their works, D. F. Strauss's Rationalistic Life of Jesus achieved lasting note in the history of New Testament criticism. But their most lasting memorial was the recruitment of the young Karl Marx. Marx's starting point is that of the earlier Hegel. His own wish to criticize Hegel's heirs, whether left or right, led him later on to emphasize the contrast between himself and Hegel, and subsequent Marxists have had other reasons for suppressing the Hegelian aspects of Marx. But this has led to falsification of Marx, whose central concept is that of freedom, and of freedom in the Hegelian sense. Hegel had written of the idea of freedom that this very idea itself is the actuality of man, not something which they have as man, but which they are. Marx wrote that freedom is so much the essence of man that even its opponents realize it. No man fights freedom. He fights at most the freedom of others. Footnote: Discussion of Press Debates in Marx Engels Gesamtausgabe 1.1.1. Like Hegel, Marx envisages freedom in terms of the overcoming of the limitations and constraints of one social order by bringing another, less limited social order into being. Unlike Hegel, he does not see those limitations and constraints as primarily the limitations and constraints of a given conceptual scheme. What constitutes a social order, what constitutes both its possibilities and its limitations, is the dominant form of work by which its material sustenance is produced. The forms of work vary with the forms of technology, and both the division of labor and the consequent division of masters and laborers are divisive of human society, producing classes and conflicts between them. The conceptual schemes through which men grasp their own society have a dual role. They both partly reveal the nature of that activity and partly conceal its true character. So the critique of concepts and the struggle to transform society necessarily go hand in hand, although in different periods the relation between these two tasks will be different. This replacement of the Hegelian self-development of the absolute idea by the economic and social history of classes leads to a transformation of the Hegelian view of individualism. For Hegel, the various individualist conceptual schemes were both an achievement and a barrier to further achievement, stages in the development of human consciousness about morality, which in turn reveal their particular limitations. So, too, they are for Marx. But they can only be understood by being interpreted in the context of bourgeois society. The essence of bourgeois society is technical innovation in the interests of capital accumulation. The bonds of feudal society are destroyed, a spirit of enterprise is unleashed, and the power of man over nature is indefinitely extended. Hence, in bourgeois social life, the concept of freedom of the individual, liberated into a free market economy, is central. but the freedoms which the individual enjoys in what Hegel called civil, Marx-bourgeois society are partly illusory. For the social and economic forms of that same society imprison the free individual in a set of relationships which nullify his civil and legal freedom and stunt his growth. In all societies, the nature of human labor and of social organization has resulted in an inability of man to understand himself and his possibilities except in distorted forms. Men see themselves in the grip of impersonal powers and forces, which are in fact their own forms of social life, the fruits of their own actions falsely objectified and endowed with independent existence. Equally, they see themselves as free agents in areas of their life where the economic and social forms are in fact dictating the roles they live out. These twin and inescapable illusions constitute the alienation of man, his loss of the grasp of his own nature. In bourgeois society, alienation exemplifies itself in the institutions of private property, which in turn exacerbate alienations. Individualist moral philosophers share in both the liberating and the constricting characteristics of bourgeois society. They represent both the genuine advance in human liberation, which it represents, and its specific form of human alienation. For Marx, in his early systematic writings, the key contrast in bourgeois society is between what bourgeois philosophy and political economy reveal about human possibility and what the empirical study of bourgeois society reveals about the contemporary human activity. The freedom destroyed by bourgeois economy and the human needs with bourgeois industry fails to meet stand in judgment on that economy and industry. But this is not merely an appeal to the ideal against the real. For the goals of freedom and of human need are the goals implicit in the struggle of the working class in bourgeois society. But the goals have to be specified in terms of the achievement of a new form of society in which class division, and with it bourgeois society, would be abolished. That is, within bourgeois society there are two social groups and at least constituted by the dominant and the dominated class. Each of these has its own fundamental goals and form of life. It follows that moral precepts may find a role within the social life of each class. But there are no independent, transcendent norms which are above those issues which divide the classes. Certainly, many of the same precepts will occur in the moralities of each class, simply in virtue of each class being a human group. But these will not serve to determine the relations between classes. When this background has been filled in, one can, I think, understand Marx's attitudes on various occasions to the passing of moral judgments as entirely self-consistent. Marx, on one hand, believed that in matters of conflict between social classes, the appeal to moral judgments was not only pointless, but positively misleading. So he tried to excise from documents of the First International appeals for justice for the working class. For to whom are these appeals being made? Presumably to those responsible for exploitation. But they are acting in accordance with the norms of their class, and although individual philanthropic moralists may be found among the bourgeoisie, philanthropy cannot alter class structure. But one may nonetheless use morally evaluative language in at least two ways. One may use it simply in the course of describing actions and institutions. No language adequately descriptive of slavery could fail to be condemnatory to anyone with certain attitudes and aims. Or one may use it explicitly to condemn, appealing not to some independent classless tribunal, but to the terms in which one's opponents have themselves chosen to be judged. So in the manifesto, Marx throws back the charges leveled against communism by bourgeois critics, arguing that they stand condemned not on his premises but on their own. We can express Marx's attitude to morality in another way. The use of moral vocabulary always presupposes a shared form of social order. Appeal to moral principles against some existing state of affairs is always an appeal within the limits of that form of society. To appeal against that form of society, we must find a vocabulary which does not presuppose its existence. Such a vocabulary one finds in the form of expression of wants and needs, which are unsatisfiable within the existing society, wants and needs which demand a new social order. So Marx appeals to the wants and needs of the working class against the social order of bourgeois society. But he never raises two questions which are crucial for his own doctrine. The first concerns the role of morality within the working class movement. Because he sees the creation of the working class as economically determined by the development of capitalism, and because he believes that the necessity of capitalism will force the working class into self-conscious antagonism to capitalism, he never discusses the question of what principles of action are to inform the working class movement. This omission is part of a more general lacuna in his argument. About the nature of the decline of capitalist economy, Marx is sufficiently specific. About the details of a socialist economy, although what he says is sparse, we may take him to be adequate from his own point of view. But about the nature of the transition from capitalism to socialism, he is unclear. Hence, we remain uncertain as to how Marx conceives it possible that a society prey to the errors of moral individualism may come to recognize and transcend them. Marx's second great omission concerns the morality of socialist and communist society. He does indeed speak in at least one passage as though communism will be an embodiment of the Kantian kingdom of ends. But he is at best allusive on this topic. The consequence of these two related omissions is that Marx left later Marxists room for interpolation at this point. What he could not have foreseen is what would be interpolated. Bernstein, the revisionist Marxist, who did not believe that socialism would arrive in the predictable future, tried to find a Kantian basis for the labor movement's activities. Kautsky saw that in Bernstein's hands, the appeal to the categorical imperative became exactly the kind of appeal to a morality above class and above society which Marx condemned. What he offered in its place, however, was simply a crude utilitarianism. The weakness to which this exposed latter-day Marxism can only be made clear when we have examined utilitarianism itself. Chapter 16. Kierkegaard to Nietzsche. The Kantian individual finds the test for his maxims in the objective test of the categorical imperative. The Hegelian individual finds his criteria in the norms of the free and rational society. The fundamental doctrine of Søren Kierkegaard is that not only are there no genuine objective tests in morality, but that doctrines which assert that there are function as devices to disguise the fact that our moral standards are and can only be chosen. The individual utters his moral precepts to himself in a far stronger sense than the Kantian individual did, for their only sanction and authority is that he has chosen to utter them. Kierkegaard was born in Copenhagen in 1813. The radical form of Protestant Christianity, which he embraced, and his rejection of Hegel's doctrines both spring from the same source, the fundamental role which he allots to the act of choice. It is not just in morals, but in every sphere which touches on human existence that the relevant criteria lack objective justification. Such justification may be in place in mathematics and in the natural sciences, but elsewhere rational argument can do no more than to present us with alternatives between which we must make our own choices. Some of Kierkegaard's own writings take the form of such a presentation. Various literary devices, such as the use of pseudonyms, being employed to conceal the fact that it is one and the same man who is advancing the rival claims of contrasting and conflicting positions. But this is not mere irrationalism, an arbitrary exaltation of arbitrary choice. For Kierkegaard believes that rational argument itself shows us that in the end the choice of the individual must be sovereign. Suppose that one believes that one's moral position can be rationally justified, that it is a conclusion which can be validly derived from certain premises. Then these premises, in turn, must be vindicated, and if their vindication consists in deriving them from conclusions based on more fundamental premises, the same problem will arise. But the chain of reasons must have an ending, and we must reach a point where we simply choose to stand by certain premises. At this point, decision has replaced argument, and in all arguments on human existence, there will be some such point. This argument is applied to moral questions in Kierkegaard's early work, Either Or. Here Kierkegaard contrasts two ways of life, which he calls the ethical and the aesthetic. The aesthetic life is that of the man whose only goal is his own satisfaction. What he must avoid are pain and boredom. Romantic love, which exists only to satisfy the passion of the moment and is ever flying to new satisfactions, is his characteristic sexual relationship. Marriage, with its lifelong and inescapable duties, is characteristics of the ethical, which is the sphere of obligations, of rules which admit of no exception. The arguments in favor of the ethical mode of life are put into the mouth of Judge Wilhelm. Those in favor of the aesthetic are taken ostensibly from the papers of a younger anonymous figure, A. The two arguments cannot meet, for Judge Wilhelm uses ethical criteria to judge between the ethical and the aesthetic, while A uses aesthetic criteria. The argument of each depends upon a prior choice, and the prior choice settles what the conclusion of each argument will be. And the reader, too, must choose. But the careful reader may well begin to have doubts here of at least two kinds. The first is drawn from the nature of Kierkegaard's own presentation. For while Kierkegaard claims to be neutral between the two positions, one can have no doubt which he favors. He describes the aesthetic state of mind as one of permanent and ever-renewed dissatisfaction, of traveling hopefully so as not to arrive. The ethical, by contrast, appears as a realm of quiet satisfaction in the obligation fulfilled, the limited task well done. The very disclaimer of partisanship by Kierkegaard itself has a partisan effect in favor of the ethical. But is this just perhaps a flaw in the literary achievement? Could not Kierkegaard have presented a genuinely neutral account of the two standpoints? Only if we suppose it possible to address an individual who is devoid of desires, goals, and needs prior to the presentation of the two cases. As such, the individual would be almost a man without characteristics. He acquires them only through his choices. But who is this I who chooses? And for such a being, what can hang in any case upon choosing in one way rather than in another? These questions never receive an answer in Kierkegaard, partly because he treats the individual as an ultimate category, and partly because he understands the real existence of the individual as being what the individual is before God. For Kierkegaard, the ethical is only a prologue to the religious, and the religious is necessarily offensive to human reason. One of Hegel's key faults in Kierkegaard's eyes was that he tried to present religion in rational terms. But from an authentically Christian point of view, Christianity must be seen as bringing the truth to a human reason which does not possess it, which prior to the Christian revelation is alien to the truth. So it is that from the standpoint of a self-sufficient human reason, Christianity necessarily appears as paradoxical and irrational. Christian faith depends not on argument but on choice, both for the more general reasons cited by Kierkegaard, which I have already mentioned, and for these special reasons. Skeptical objections to Christianity are not in reality grounded on intellectual doubt. They arise from insubordination, unwillingness to obey, rebellion against all authority. Hence, the important decision is either to do or not to do what God commands in His self-revelation. The example Kierkegaard invokes is that of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham is commanded by God to sacrifice his son. This command is contrary not merely to inclination but also to duty. What God commands is, from the standpoint of the ethical, simple murder. There is thus a break between the highest merely human consciousness and the divine intrusion of the apparently scandalous and absurd. It is important to note that there is not a hint in Kierkegaard of the view taken by some Old Testament critics that the function of this story was to preach the abolition of human sacrifice and to educate the Hebrews into a belief that such a killing was in fact not what God willed, but murder. The notion of revelation as progressive, as always suited to, but always slightly above the moral level of, those to whom it is addressed, is alien to Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard then stands at an extreme point, both in the development of Christianity and in the development of individualism. So far as Christianity is concerned, he poses one horn of a dilemma which had been arising for Christianity ever since the revival of Aristotle in the Middle Ages. Either Christianity accepts the terms of secular reason and argues on these, or it insists on being judged by no criteria but its own. The first alternative leads, as Kierkegaard saw it lead in Hegel's writings, to the reduction of Christianity to something other than itself. The second leads to Christianity becoming self-enclosed and unintelligible. Theologians who recognize this have sometimes been dismayed by Kierkegaard's candor. But Kierkegaard's type of Christianity is in some ways a natural counterpart to his individualism. For it is only when writing from within a Christian position that Kierkegaard can find any reasons for answering the question, "How shall I live?" in one way rather than another. One may suspect that the need to be able to answer this question is one of the unavowed sources of his Christianity. The choices made by the individual confronting the alternatives of the ethical and the aesthetic, or the ethical and the religious, are according to Kierkegaard criterionless. But if this were genuinely so, how could it be right to choose one rather than the other? Yet the whole point of such choices and of the pain that the making of them involves is that one may choose wrongly. Kierkegaard's conceptual framework makes it impossible to say this, although sometimes Kierkegaard himself is inconsistent enough to use this kind of language. He moves uneasily between speaking from within an order in which God's will provides criteria for action and speaking as the lonely individual outside all criteria. Of Kierkegaard's themes, at least one, that of the irrationality of Christianity, reappears in the strange, ironical pages of Heinrich Heine's History of Philosophy and Religion in Germany,